You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for February 6th. I'm Joe Elia. We offer news headlines and an interview. Our interview this week examines the notion that preparing hospital patients for discharge can save money and lower readmissions. But is this in anyone's interest? Now here are the week's top clinical headlines. First, a couple of position papers on type 2 diabetes. Next, 64-slice CT angiography is the equivalent of 600 chest x-rays. And third, routine lower back imaging is a waste of time. Here are some details. There were a couple of new position papers on type 2 diabetes in the January edition of Diabetes Care. The first, a joint statement from the American Diabetes Association, the American Heart Association, and the American College of Cardiology, calls into question some recent findings that intensive glucose control did not, as expected, prevent cardiovascular complications. The statement says that control may not have been close enough to show a difference in risk. It says intensive control might lower risks in younger patients or newly found disease. The second position paper offers treatment algorithms for the disease, including a glycosylated hemoglobin target of 7% or less. Writing in Journal Watch General Medicine, Alan Brett says that, quotes, clinicians who care for patients with diabetes should review these sensibly written papers, end quotes. Next, your patients may be getting more radiation than you think from CT angiography. In an international survey of some 50 centers, the median dose of radiation delivered during the procedure was equivalent to 600 chest x-rays, and the doses delivered at the highest and lowest centers differed more than sixfold. An editorialist writing in JAMA says the results should serve as a wake-up call to centers not using the latest dose reduction methods. Last in the week's news, but not in importance, is the reminder that routine imaging of low back pain in the absence of signs of a serious underlying condition is, to put it bluntly, a waste of time. The authors put it more diplomatically in Lancet, saying that, quote, clinicians should refrain, end quote, from such routine imaging. Although Lancet's commentators wonder whether the widespread practice will be easily changed given patient expectations and reimbursement incentives. Next, our interview. The latest edition of the Annals of Internal Medicine presents a study on hospital discharge. The study, which was done here in Boston, followed 750 patients about to be discharged from the general medical service of an urban hospital. The 750 patients were randomized to one of two groups. One group got the usual discharge procedures, but the other received a more attentive exit. Before discharge, members of the intervention group sat with a nurse, called a nurse discharge advocate, whose job was to create an after-hospital care plan. The care plan contained contact information on how to get in touch with a medical provider in case something went wrong. Also, appointment dates, lists of pending test results, information about drugs and dosage schedules, and information about the discharge diagnosis. Not only did the patient get this information, but the primary care physician also got it. It was faxed to the physician's office on the day of discharge. Plus, a pharmacist called the patient within a few days to see whether there were any problems with drugs or anything else. Over the next 30 days, the intervention group's rate of rehospitalization or visits to the emergency room was about a third lower than the usual care group. Likewise, the actual costs of those visits for each group were about a third lower in the intervention group. The first author on the paper, Dr. Brian Jack, has kindly agreed to talk with me about his project, which is called Project RED for Re-Engineered Discharge. Dr. Jack is in the Department of Family Medicine at Boston University School of Medicine. Thanks for being here, Dr. Jack.
Hi, Joe. It's my pleasure to be here today.
Brian, how did you get interested in the whole question of re-engineered discharge?
As a clinician, I have been working in the hospital for many years, seeing patients and teaching residents. And here at Boston Medical Center, we have a large number of patients who are admitted to the hospital, and it's been my experience that the readmission rates are high. And in some ways, the interns know the patients that are readmitted over and over again through the year, but there's very few formalized programs to try to decrease the readmission rate.
And that's at about 20 or 25% of people that are readmitted within a certain length of time, aren't they?
That's correct. Yeah. It's for Medicare patients, it's about 20% of patients are readmitted within 30 days.
Uh-huh.
And it's very clear that many of these are avoidable rehospitalization.
Uh-huh.
From my primary care point of view, also on the other end of the transition, I've received patients who have been in the hospital without enough information or an adequate discharge summary in order to take adequate care of these patients. And from that perspective, I've readmitted patients to the hospital, even though in some cases all the right things have been done, but that the information hadn't been communicated to me so that it was unclear where to go with a particular patient. Also, in my observations, I've seen the process of discharge, and in many cases, the clinical team's responsibilities are to admit the new sick patients from the emergency room. The incentives are to get patients, sick patients into the hospital, get the relatively healthy patients who are going home that day home as quick as possible.
Yes.
And not a lot of attention is paid to preparing them to go home to take care of themselves. And there are examples, I observed once where the decisions are made also at the very end of the hospitalization. And it doesn't give the nurses and the residents and the attendings and the case managers enough time to really properly prepare the patients. And in one case I remember, the patient was to be sent home on Lovenox Bridge until their Coumadin was, again, therapeutic. And because of the rush and the family member was outside the hospital and the car was running, waiting for the patient to be discharged, the nurse went in with a cellophane-wrapped box and said, in this box is a CD that explains how to inject yourself with Lovenox for the next few days until your Coumadin is therapeutic again. And when you go home, you can watch this CD and learn how to inject yourself. And I sat there and said, gee, we can do a lot better than this.
I'd hope so. It sounds in some instances, in the worst case scenarios, it sounds like hospitals are trying to move people through the way that they do in airports.
Yeah, I think that's right. Although in airports, the pilot and the co-pilot get in the plane and they go through the checklist of the pre-takeoff checklist, and they do that every time. It doesn't matter if it's a rainy day or a sunny day or a snowy day. They do it every single time.
Yeah.
In the hospital, we have no such checklist until now, and that's what I think Project Red checklist offers us. Another sort of inspiration for the project was that that the length of stay was getting shorter and shorter, mm-hmm. and that their patients were being discharged earlier, and I think with less and less preparation, and also with the advent of fewer primary care physicians taking care of their patients in the hospital and the rise of hospitals in the hospital, it adds an additional challenge of getting the information from the hospital back to the primary care site. And over the last few years, I think a lot of us have recognized that communication is not what it used to be when it was relatively seamless. And we need to improve and set up new mechanisms for how we can improve that kind of communication and to prepare the patient to care for themselves once they're discharged until they have their first primary care visit. Some people have referred to that as the black box, the time from right. discharge until the first primary care visit. And I like to think of it as the time of self-care.
Yeah.
Patients during that time need to care for themselves, and they've been in the hospital, and hospital staff has been taking care of them in terms of their medications and bandage changes and all the other things that have to happen clinically. And then patients go home, and we simply don't prepare them adequately for the challenge of caring for themselves. So a lot of what this project was about was to identify the things that they need to do to take care of themselves and to teach them how to do that.
Now, when you made the comparison between the two groups, did the findings, did the differences between those results surprise you?
We were surprised at the degree to which we were able to reduce ED visits and rehospitalizations.
Mm-hmm.
We were were expecting, and our a priori hypothesis was that we would decrease total hospital utilization, that is the sum of ED visits and rehospitalization,
right,
and had calculated a sample size that was adequate to do that. But that the degree to which we were able to lower it was a surprise even to us.
Do you think that the use of a checklist that the nurse discharge advocate went through and that the pharmacist went through, making sure that the patient understood things, making sure that they knew when their appointments were going to happen and that they were lab tests that were yet to be delivered, do you think that going through that methodically was the key? Or do you think that, there was a human factor there that, somebody's paying attention to me?
Yeah, there's no question that patient satisfaction went way up, and we also showed that. People like it a lot, and family members really like it.
Hmm.
And when I talk about this around the country, people respond in a very personal way. They say, gee, my Uncle Joe could have really benefited from something like this.
Yeah,
because we all know people, older people especially, who come home from the hospital. The average is 7 or 8 different medicines, and there's often lots of confusion about what to do exactly. We did a lot of preliminary studies to identify what that checklist ought to be, and now we look at it and it seems sort of self-evident that, gee, we really ought to be able to do each of these things before we go home, but clearly we don't do that. But there's lots of redundancy, there's lots of gaps. One of the real issues is that nobody's really in charge of the discharge. Is it, in most hospitals, the nurse's responsibility, or is it the resident team's responsibilities, the attending physician, the case manager? The answer is that it's not been defined in most hospitals. So that when the responsibility is unclear, then it becomes no one's responsibility. And what we found is there's lots of redundancy in what people tell patients and lots of gaps in knowledge. There was a study that came out this last year where they audio taped a number of discharges, and the average time was about 7 minutes. And again, gaps and redundancies and lots of missing information and no attempt at teach-back or understanding how well the patient understands what to do exactly. In our study, the pharmacist called patients in the intervention group 2 to 4 days afterwards. And it's not in the paper, but we'll have another publication soon that will describe this, shows that half the patients in the intervention group who have had all this attention to detail regarding their discharge, half of them had something about their medications that needed to be corrected. In other words, half of them were confused about what to do just with their medications. And as I say that to people, that really rings true, that patients go home and that there's a lot of confusion about what to do. When we first thought about this idea, it was very much from a clinical point of view. Boy, this is a big problem. No one has looked at it so closely. I sent a grant into ARC, which is the Agency for Health Research and Quality, who have been extraordinarily supportive of this work. And we proposed at that point a randomized trial of something that was the sort of the early version of Project RED. The grant reviewers, in their wisdom, wrote back and said, this is a good idea, but what is the hospital discharge? Because no one had ever really identified what its components were. And then we applied for another smaller grant called the Challenge Grant out of the ARC Patient Safety Portfolio, which was a year of intensive work looking at the hospital discharge to characterize its components. Patient safety methodologies now often borrow from engineering, hence the name, the re-engineered discharge. And during that year, we did things like qualitative analysis and had qualitative researchers talk to people who were being discharged and had been discharged to find out what the problems were, and to nurses and to doctors. We did a thing called process mapping, which is to identify each step along the way of the hospital discharge. And in my office now, we have a big poster with lots and lots of arrows and boxes and things about what actually needs to be done at the discharge. It's a much more complex process than you would initially think. It's not so much, here's your prescription, see you later, which is what happens.
To do it correctly,
there's a lot of arrows pointing in different directions. One is, for example, just the decision to send somebody home, you know, there has to be discussions among the doctors, among the consultants, with the case manager, with the receiving facility, with the family, with the patient, with the nurses, and lots of other people. It's, even that decision is not so easy. And then we found, we looked at things like tests that were scheduled to be done after discharge, and analyzed them in a method called failure modes effects analysis, which is to look at the process map and see where things are likely to break down. And we used the example of someone who came in for chest pain and was ruled out for a myocardial infarction, was scheduled to have a stress test as an outpatient. It turns out, in our system, only about half the people who are scheduled to have those tests get them done. And that it's, again, not so simple, because people need to be scheduled on a day that they can actually go. They have to come to the campus, and there are several places on the campus where stress tests are done, so they have to get to the right place at the right time, or else it won't be done. The test then is done and then sent to, say, a community health center, where the result has to get to the right physician. The patient then has to make another appointment at the right health center at the right time to meet the right physician who has the result, and that whole thing only works about half the time. And again, we can do better than that, and there are systems changes that can be done to facilitate a lot of those processes.
Now, a lot of the resources that that you put together, as a matter of fact, one of these hospital discharge booklets, those are available on the RED website. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah,
yes.
I will.
Our website is available, and people can download the after hospital care plan, as well as the re-engineered discharge checklist, as well as the training manuals that we use to train the nurses, the nurse discharge advocates, who are research nurses in the study, so that other hospitals can utilize this information.
And I will put the URLs for those resources on the record of the podcast, so people who go to podcasts.jwatch.org we'll have the list of resources that we've just talked about.
That's terrific. Yeah.
Just to be
clear about that, Joe. Just the process for the discharge advocate nurses was that they would go in and starting a day or two before discharge, or as early as possible, because some people actually would go home the same day.
Yeah.
Would be to collect the information necessary. And that those are the things that are in the re-engineered discharge list, like the medicines that they're going to be going home on that are been reconciled with the ambulatory list, a list of those tests that need to be done after discharge, the appointments that are scheduled to be done. And we made an appointment for all the subjects on discharge within 2 weeks, a list of tests that have been done in the hospital and the results of which are not back yet. We talked to patients about what constitutes an emergency and what to do in case of an emergency, or if they have questions, and gave them contact numbers so that they could access the right person, depending on what happens in the future, et cetera. And that constitutes the re-engineered discharge process. So the discharge nurses put together this information, gathered it all together, and then they packaged it in this tool, which is called the After Hospital Care Plan.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent a lot of time and effort looking at the after-hospital care plan and had graphic designers and health literacy experts and others help us in designing it. And in the design process, I said, we need to think comic book. We need something that is very understandable to people. And this constitutes then the discharge plan, which is another element of the re-engineered discharge, that every patient should go home with a discharge plan that's understandable to them. And in our system, it's called the after-hospital care plan, and it's designed in color with big letters, the name of the patient there. It used to be called the discharge plan, but people we found didn't understand the word discharge often. Now the after-hospital care plan has a picture of their primary care physician in the corner, contact numbers, and then has lots of elements. So, for example, the medications are listed with lots of icons in terms of the time of day to take them, and whether it's a pill or an injection or a liquid, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's very clear in terms of what is it, why I need to take it, why it's important for me, without a lot of pathophysiology and all that sort of stuff, and certainly not Latin in terms of 1POTID. And then the appointment section is color-coded. So the appointment with the primary care physician, with, say, the rheumatologist and the VNA who's going to be visiting, an appointment for the stress test next week, is in another section, and they're color-coded to a calendar of the next 30 days so that the green PCP appointment will be on the calendar with the doctor's name on it. And it opens up so that the medicines are at the top, the calendar is at the bottom, color-coded to what they need to do over the next 30 days to take care of themselves. And people really responded very favorably to that. And then we give them a little test, and we say, gee, these are the medicines that you're going to be taking. Can you tell me how many times a day you take your lisinopril, for example, so that we have a good idea before they go home how well they understand what they are to do? And if they don't, then we spend more time talking to them about not memorizing the list of medicines they're supposed to take, but so they simply can read the after-hospital care plan.
Oh.
And the after-hospital care plan is very distinct to the discharge summary. The discharge summary is for clinicians to see what happened during the hospitalization. The discharge plan is for patients so they know what to do to take care of themselves when they go home. I think through the years we've confused those two concepts quite a lot.
I see. Now, in the article itself, I thought you said that the primary care physician also gets a copy of the after-hospital care plan faxed to them. Is that?
That's true.
It is true.
And
okay.
And the discharge summary.
And the summary. Okay. All right. Good.
Yeah, that's right.
As you mentioned in the paper, about a third of the cost was saved by using this strategy. And the problem is with incentives here, though, isn't it? Who has an incentive, unless, as you say, the hospital is under a capitation plan? The hospital has no incentive to keep people out of its doors, does it?
Yeah, it really doesn't. The cost savings accrued in the study are to the payers, the people who pay for the hospitalizations.
Yeah.
And it's clear that if we can decrease rehospitalizations, then we're going to save money because hospitalizations are expensive. The question is, who saves that money? And that hospital incentives are to admit people to the hospital, discharge them in a reasonable time when it's safe to do that, but as soon as possible. And then there's no disincentive for readmitting them as quickly as possible right now.
Yeah.
And that there are, of course, lots of discussions now with CMS and other big payers about changing the mechanism for payment for rehospitalization. If that happens, then suddenly hospitals will have a great incentive to better prepare their patients prior to discharge so that they are less likely to be readmitted unnecessarily.
So if it becomes a measure of quality assessment, then it's in their interests to make sure that their numbers are good.
More and more the 30-day rehospitalization rate seems to be a quality measure that people are looking at. One thing we haven't talked about is that when we developed the re-engineered discharge process, and before we did the randomized trial, I had some conversations with the National Quality Forum Safe Practice Committee.
Uh-huh.
And they, at that point, had no safe practice on hospital discharge procedures. And they asked me to write the National Quality Forum Safe Practice, which was approved by the National Quality Forum. So now the re-engineered discharge process is the National Quality Forum Safe Practice number 11, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And the National Quality Forum for the safe practices is an umbrella organization for CMS and Institute for Healthcare Improvement and LeapFrog and JCO and others, so that the re-engineered discharge is now the process that people ought to follow. And when that happened, I said, gee, this is interesting, but shouldn't we do a study to show that if hospitals complete this process on all 38 million discharges across the country, what is it that the hospital should expect in return for doing that?
Yeah.
So we did that study, and that's what was reported in this most recent publication.
So do you have other publications coming up? Are you still pursuing this line of research?
We certainly are, Joe, and that we knew early on that people would ask that even though there's an overall cost savings, that it was clear that the accrual went to the payers, not to the hospital. So the question is, how can we help and assist hospitals in spending the time necessary to collect the information, package it into the after-hospital care plan, and then teach it to the patient. And that takes a little bit of time, not so much, but a little bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in the big picture is cost-saving. So there are many procedures and processes in the hospital. Nurses are very busy. They are more worried about the sick patient coming up and the healthy patient going home.
Right.
There's real pressure to get new patients into those beds. And once the decision is made to send somebody home, there's not much reason to spend time with them under the current circumstances. So we thought that if there was some way that we could help streamline the process of actually doing the re-engineered discharge process, that would be very helpful. So several years ago, we teamed up with a computer scientist at Northeastern University, Dr. Tim Bickmore, who as a graduate student in the media lab at MIT had invented a computer-based animated character that speaks from a large database and creates sentences that way. So we then applied for a grant from the NIH, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, to create this new health information technology system that would be a computerized animated character that speaks empathically to patients about their discharge plan and teaches the after-hospital care plan automatically. So that's what we've been working on for the last couple of years, and right now we're doing a second randomized trial in the hospital comparing the after-hospital care plan taught by Louise, who's our animated character in the computer, compared to usual care. And we've enrolled now about 150 patients, and we'll enroll about 800 again to see how these results compare to the current paper and to the control group.
Well,
so we're very excited about this, and that Dr. Bickmore's interest is creating computerized characters that can speak in a relational way, so that they can connect with people with hand gestures and voice modulation and facial gestures and the words, of course, that they use. So that we're trying to interject bedside manner into a computerized character for this particular application, which is to prepare people for the hospital discharge. We've also, Joe, created what we call a workstation, which is a software database, so that rather than creating the after-hospital care plan on a computer kind of freehand, we now have a program with drop-down menus where we can enter in all the re-engineered discharge elements into this software program, push a button, and the after-hospital care plan prints automatically in color. We then bind it up in a spiral binder and then go in and teach the patient. In the new study, we create the after-hospital care plan, give it to the patient, roll in the computer, push the button, and Louise, the animated character, then teaches the after-hospital care plan to patients.
Hmm.
If this is shown to be as effective as a nurse, then it will save enormous amounts of hospital time and increase the cost savings dramatically. And I think in a big way, this is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what health information technology can provide to us in the future in terms of cost savings around the area of patient education and health promotion.
Well, I'm going to be looking out for this new research as it comes out in the next year or two. I want to thank you, Dr. Brian Jack, for taking the time to talk with me today.
It's been my pleasure, Joe.
Well, have a great week of healing. And if you want to comment, call 617-440-4374. Links for all of the stories and access to all our older interviews are at podcasts.jwatch.org. Our executive producer is Adore Yano, and I'm Joe Elia, executive talker. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to Admitting Diagnosis.